DBE and VLRC, thank you for this morning. Unfortunately, Chair has just been held up in another engagement. She will join us a bit later, but we need to start for time. And I'm going to now call upon in nomination acting chairperson until the chairperson arrives at the meeting. Honourable Basson.
Thank you, Chair. I nominated the name of Ms. Khosa Hlamalang to act meantime. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Basson. Honourable Basson has nominated Honourable Khosa. Is there a seconder for that nomination? Honourable Bortis?
I wish to echo the same sentiment, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Bortis. Are there any further nominations for acting chairperson? In the absence of which, I will call upon Honourable Khosa to join us at the chair. Thank you very much. And there goes my chairpersonship.
Thank you very much. Good morning, colleagues. Before we allow the DG to vote, we'll allow you, DG, to vote after this meeting, for the next meeting in the afternoon. So, honorable members and the department, we have two items this morning to deal with. The first one will start by the ELRC presentation. Before I afford them an opportunity to do their presentation, I will want to check with the DG to if there is something that you want to say.
Honorable Chair, honorable members, ELRC Chair and the General Secretary and colleagues, Chair, I don't have anything safe to say that I will request to be excused at 10 o'clock. That's the only thing.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chair. You will be excused at that time. And I don't know, Mr. Brown, do you have any apologies?
Thank you, Chairperson. Of course, the apology from the Chairperson, who may join us a bit late. I've also got an apology from Honourable Mokoto. She will try her best to be a bit later. If not, she may not make it for the meeting. And then I also have an apology for Honourable Macheke and Honourable Mkize.
Oh, thank you very much. From the floor, any other apology? Can we just check? No other apologies. Thank you very much. There will be no other apologies. Honorable Chair, you are welcome. Can I hand over to ELRC to give us a presentation? ELRC, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I was looking at my chairperson to officially introduce the ERC, but I have been delegated the powers to introduce the ERC. The DG had already done that. We first want to appreciate the invitation from the committee to come and present on, amongst others, the collective agreements and the work that we're doing. You would recall, Chairperson, that we used to come and present to the Portfolio Committee even in terms of our performance up until the point where we were delisted. And when we left at the time, we did make an undertaking to the committee and also to the Chairperson to say, because we exist within the space of public education, whatever work we do, it is to support the work of education of the country. At any given point in time, when the committee deems fit for us to come and engage or report on our work, we would be happy to come. So that is just my intro to appreciate why we are here and the invitation itself. Chair, in responding to the invite, we have prepared the presentation, and again, we will welcome any questions, even if such matters are not part of the presentation, should the committee deem fit to respond to that. Our presentation is going to be in two parts. The first part is going to be taking the committee through the collective agreements that have been concluded by council. There's a range of them, but we thought agreements that are more administrative in nature, we won't bother the committee by presenting on such, but we want to talk mainly to those that are making an impact, positively so, in the education system of the country. So hence we have that list. You'll see the sequencing is not necessarily the way it should be. Hence we have selected only those that we consider to be critical for the engagements today. The second part, Chair, is going to reflect a bit on the other initiatives that the Council has put in place, again, in contributing towards the improvement of the public quality education. Chair, we thought let's remind the committee of our legislative framework. We exist in terms of the LRA, and in existing in terms of the LRA, because the LRA gives effect to the constitution of the country, in particular Section 23, which is a right to fair labor practices. But by virtue of operating in education, we also have an obligation to give effect to Section 28 of the Constitution, which is the rights of children being paramount in any processes that we are undertaking. We also have other supporting legislations, which we have not covered, but I think we saw it fit that we highlight in particular the Children's Act, because a greater part of our presentation is going to be showing how do we bring that to the processes of the ELRC. Chair, without taking too much time, I want to quickly talk to Collective Agreement Number 2 of 2018. Collective Agreement Number 2, I'm not going to talk to slide by slide, I'm just going to summarize, because I want to believe that the committee has had time to look at the presentation itself. We would know that in the media there have been reports that the educators in South Africa are taking up contracts in abroad because they hold the view that they are able to make more money when they leave the country, take a two-year contract and then come back to the system and they are employed again. Now, obviously they are exercising their rights, but the challenge that has been in the system prior to the signing of this agreement was that such educators, when they leave, at the time of them exiting the system, I'll make an example of a school principal who has 15 years or 20 years in that position. Because of grade progression, that principal will be earning a lot of money. Of course, they've earned it. But if you look at the starting salary of a principal who's appointed this year, you'd compare to a principal who has 15 years in the system, the difference will be huge. Now, the problem with the previous provision was that such a principal, if they resign for their reasons, being they want to go and study or go and work abroad, whatever reason it is, they would resign, they would be reappointed. When they are reappointed, they retain the salary that they were earning prior to them exiting the system. Now, in essence, it means it is polarizing the system because you are rewarding a person who has left. But that person who has remained in the system will still be down there at the entry level. I've made an example of a school principal that was applicable in all positions. The challenges with that is polarizing the environment in the school system because those who have not resigned will still be earning the salary that they were earning. The person who had left but now is coming back, it's like you are rewarding them. And it was not making sense. It was costing the state a lot of money, and it was causing unhappiness amongst the workers. We also need to put it up front, Chairperson, that this agreement is not supported by some of the teacher unions because they are of the view that it's a down variation of the existing benefits that are there. But because it is supported by the majority, it is going to enjoy full force and effect, and as such, it is implemented despite it not being supported by others. But the system itself is going to benefit because now whatever savings that are there can be utilized to employ more teachers in the system or even reward those who are showing commitment and loyalty to the system itself. That is the first collective agreement, Chair. I'm not going to go to the technical aspects, but I have highlighted the differences between the two, which talks exactly to what I've just explained. The only provision that is made in the amendment to that existing, that provision that was there, they will still, a person who has left, if one had had 6 years of uninterrupted service in the system, that will still be recognized because you will still be awarded 6 notches. So at least experience is recognized. But what we are doing away is a person retaining the salary that they were earning prior to them exiting the system. And that is informed also by the law of contracts, because the contract that was giving them that benefit now has been terminated when you resign. So therefore, when you rejoin the system, when you are reappointed, it should be starting from scratch because it's a new contract of employment. So that is the summary in terms of the first collective agreement. Then, Chair, I want to move to the collective agreement that we think, if we were to use the language of the court judgments, it's a landmark collective agreement. Why do we say that, Chair? Because currently the country is grappling with the abuse of learners in the system by educators, especially the sexual offences. Now, what we have been grappling with as the ELRC, we would always get involved at the time when the teacher would have been subjected to an internal disciplinary process by the department. The department will find the teacher guilty, but that teacher, in terms of the EEA, has got a right to submit an appeal to the MEC of Education. And only after the MEC would have responded to that appeal, that an educator will refer a dispute to the ELRC. The challenge with that has been, by the time the case comes, not all cases come to the ELRC, that's number one. Number two, by the time they come to the ELRC, because it was taking long for the MECs to respond to the appeal application, in some instances it will be 3 years, 5 years, 6 years, it ranges from one province to the other. We would have a problem of not having witnesses because, number one, the learners exit the system. It could be that by the time this offense happened, they were at a primary school, now they are in a high school, and they are no longer interested because they don't see the bigger picture of saying we need to address the teacher such that it doesn't happen to the other learner. Number two, the other concern or the other problem was the parents moving learners from one province to the other because they do not want those learners to come and be victimized or be subjected to secondary trauma, because when the matter is brought to the LRC, it's yet afresh. So they must come, testify, recall all the events exactly the same way that the court will deal with it. And mind you, these educators, when they come to us, they are represented by senior counsels who are very aggressive because those are lawyers. They are representing their members who is the alleged perpetrator. Now, the parents would be then reluctant to agree that when the matter comes to the ELRC, these learners must come and testify. The other aspect, which again is also was also a concern for us, is during this period that the teacher is awaiting the outcome of the appeal, they are at home, they are not at school, of course, but they will continue earning a salary. So this person is dismissed, but because the appeal process has not been finalized, they will be paid for a period of 5 years. At the time when the MEC decides to terminate or to uphold the dismissal sanction, there is no provision that that teacher must bring back every cent that they had earned during the period of them waiting for that decision. And again, Chair, what was also of a concern to us, which I'll talk to at a later stage, there's an internal disciplinary process run by the department, there's an ELRC process, then there's a SAIS process. In all these three processes, these learners must go and lead evidence. In the absence of the learners coming to testify, the ELRC and SAIS will not be able to strike off that teacher from the roll. ELRC will not be able to uphold the dismissal sanction that would have been meted through the internal disciplinary process. Now, we looked into those and we looked at the prevalence of these sexual offenses now against the learners in the system. We then found a way of bringing about synergy between our processes and the department's process through the Section 188A of the LRA, because that section provides that either by agreement or by consent, the employees and the employer can agree to have an internal disciplinary process conducted by an arbitrator, which is what is that agreement providing for. I also need to mention, Chair, that in when these cases are heard by the LRC, we ensure that we make use of special venues such that the learner does not come into contact with the alleged perpetrator. We are also obliged by law to appoint intermediaries so that the learner does not talk directly to the arbitrator or respond directly to the representative of an educator. Because if you appoint an intermediary, that evidence is led through a third person in the form of an intermediary. So we follow exactly the same process that is followed in a criminal proceedings by a court. So that's another advantage. And I'm not saying it was not being done, but at the time when this agreement was not there, we would not know if the internal disciplinary process was conducted under such circumstances. Now, I've spoken a lot, I've covered all these slides, Chair. I want to go quickly to one that we think I've made, or what I've omitted to mention of, because we were foreseeing this agreement being supported and implemented, we've taken initiatives to engage the Office of the Registrar for the National Sexual Offenders Register, because we were of the view that once they are found guilty through our processes, their names can be added on the register. But upon our discussion and also the thorough reading of the Act itself, our arbitration hours will not be considered for the purposes of adding the names in that specific register, because their Act specifically talks to a person who has been convicted. Now, the LRC processes are not equal to the court's processes, so there's no conviction, there's only a finding that a person is guilty. However, the registrar advised us that despite those names not being added through that process, because she works with those that are convicted by the courts of law, there is another section in the Criminal Law and Sexual Offenders Related Matters Act, Section 54, which provides for anyone who has knowledge of a person who has sexually offended a child to report such to SAPS. What then would do, SAPS compiles its own list and submits it to the Office of the Registrar. Now, when there's a requirement for anyone to be appointed as a teacher to provide the clearance from the National Register for Sexual Offences, the registrar will not provide the clearance certificate, purely because that name would be appearing on the list of the pending cases that are submitted by SAPS. So that is still a cushion. But I'll also talk to what are the recommendations for us to ensure that that information is accessible to the employers within the department. We have also, Chairperson, engaged the Department of Justice for us to be able to be granted access to the children's courts. We will be putting aside resources to put our own infrastructure, but it might take time, purely because of the fact that we've got 9 provinces and we want to make these facilities accessible such that there's no frustration from the parents and the learners to access the venues where the cases will be heard. But that is something that we will discuss, of course, with the support of the DG and the provinces, such that we put together the resources to put the infrastructure to have appropriate venues. But in the meantime, we've engaged that office, the Department of Justice, for us to make use of their children's courts, and we are winning that side. We have also utilized the Department of Justice to conduct training for us. We have taken the liberty of sharing with the committee the training manuals, such that you can be put at ease that these intermediaries that are utilized in these cases to also assist in the protection of the rights of children are subjected to strenuous training by the Department of Justice. In essence, they are training them as though they would go to the court and assist the kid in, or the learner or the child in leading the evidence in the process. So those are the initiatives that we have put in place. I've also made mention of us putting a process to implement the provisions of Section 54 of that criminal law and sexual offender-related matters. Now, Chair, I want to take 2 minutes and talk to what I had indicated earlier on, the importance of the Children's Act in the process of our operations. What is important in that act for the ELRC now that the ELRC will be conducting the disciplinary process in the form of an inquiry by the arbitrator is for our arbitrators, which we are going to put in the guidelines for them, to give effect to Section 120, which talks to finding persons unsuitable to work with children. I've quoted the relevant sections there. I don't intend to read it again. But what then this means? It means the SAIS process of striking off educators from the role in instances where they are found to be guilty of this type of misconduct is going to become an academic exercise, purely because even arbitrator in the process of that inquiry finds that the teacher is unsuitable to work for, I mean, to work with children. That report has to be submitted to the Director General, who in turn, Director General, not the one in attendance, but for social development, who is the custodian of the Register B in terms of the Children's Act. Once that name is added on that register, that individual, being a teacher or a doctor or any other profession, would not be able to work with children. Now, in the context of teachers, it therefore means having a SAIS certificate is going to be as good as not having it at all, because your name shall have been added in that register. Now, we've had discussions with SAIS to say we don't want to be seen to be usurping their powers, which are given to them in terms of their act, the SAIS Act. But however, this warrant is that there be a discussion for the purposes of amending their act, such that we bring about synergy within this process and their processes. Because we have, Chairperson, examples of very worrisome cases. The most recent one, I received correspondence from them 2 weeks back. An educator was alleged to have raped a child. The internal disciplinary process of the department dismisses the educator. The educator refers the dispute to the ELRC. The ELRC process confirms the dismissal, to be fair. I then submit the same information to SAIS for them to put in process their, to put their processes in place such that the educator is struck off from the register. I then receive the response from SAIS making reference to the same submission that I've made, which indicates that after extensive investigation, they could not find evidence for them to take the appropriate decision in the form of striking off that educator from the role. So that is just a practical demonstration of the problem that we are sitting with, purely because there are too many processes, and teachers who are committing these offenses, they always find a loophole and they succeed. Because if that teacher is not struck off the roll and the requirements for appointment is saying you must be SAIS registered, that person is going to take that certificate, go and apply for employment in another province and so forth. So those are the challenges that we are seated with. Hence we then said, I also need to mention, by the way, Chairperson, that I've been made aware by the chief negotiator of the state that there is currently a draft protocol to try and support the work of the LRC and any other institution that works with this. I think emanating from that process, some of these challenges will be addressed. And again, Chair, the issues around these processes are equally, we've been at pains trying to address the interested parties to say the existence of this agreement is going to assist both parties, the employer and the employees. Because in some instances, you get educators who are falsely accused of sexual offense by learners. because of various reasons. Either the learner had a crush on the teacher did not respond positively, or either the collusion within the staff or amongst the staff members. You would note that there's been a recent article that was on the papers where the Mpumalanga department had dismissed a teacher for the same allegations. But that teacher was reinstated as a result of an ELRC process, because the arbitrator found that the evidence that was led pointed it clearly that it was a vendetta against that teacher. So we've been giving these examples such that people can see the pros and cons of having these processes at the ELRC, because we are obliged to ensure that the processes are dealt with in a fair way. You would not find a situation where, because the ELRC has taken over the cases, therefore it's going to be an automatic dismissal. Our arbitrators are trained. They are seasoned commissioners with vast years of experience. Because this is a special panel, has been subjected to training by the Department of Justice as well, over and above the training that they get from the CCMA, for them to be able to evaluate the evidence and be able to make a determination that indeed this educator is guilty or the educator is not guilty. That educator now has to be reinstated and be paid almost 800,000 by the department for having been dismissed unfairly because of the collusion within the school. Then I've already spoken to this section. What we are also raising, Chairperson, apart from the SAIS Act, is a need for us to also get a buy-in or engage the school governing bodies, because that's another role player within these issues. Because some educators, because they know when they are dismissed because of this type of misconduct, PESAL blocks them from being re-employed by the department. They will then go and apply for SGB positions, because now they are not going to be subjected to PESAL. So there's not going to be anything red flagged. Now the school governing body will appoint them, but if you look at the fact that they will be appointed to go and work with the children again in a school environment. So we're saying we need the school governing bodies to come on board. We appreciate the fact that in terms of our constitution, we don't deal with SGB appointees. Their disputes are dealt with by the CCMA. But we are intending to engage the school governing bodies and see if there can be a protocol agreement that's going to provide that even if a teacher is an SGB employee, should they be charged of this type of misconduct, such a case must come to the ELRC, because we want to close the gap. But we also saying we also need a process in place to ensure that even in the private sector, they don't access employment. And that's when we need to have engagements. Again, those are school governing bodies, some of them are also representative of the private schools. We need to ensure that they are also brought on board. We can't take over their cases, obviously, but we are of the view that if the minister can issue some sort of a declaration that says for any teacher to be employed, you need a SAIS certificate, you need SAPS clearance, and you need to ensure that this teacher does not appear on any database, because we should ensure that all the pieces of information that is managed through databases are now synergized, such that whoever that wants to appoint, be it for public school or private school, subjects that name to that database for the name to be picked up if this teacher is committed. Because what they do, they're very clever, they beat the system, they go and apply in the private schools if they can, or they apply for the SGB positions. So that is what is required. But of importance for us, which we, of course, is subject to approval by our parties, is this strong need to revise the appointment requirements. Because currently the appointment requirements only talks to the SAIS certificate. And we need more than a SAIS certificate, because now, from the presentations that I've just ran through, it's quite clear that having a SAIS certificate does not necessarily mean the person is suitable to go and work with the children. That SAIS certificate only says you are professionally qualified to go and teach. Whether you are suitable in terms of these other pieces of legislation that the country has, it's something that we need to do something to address. Chair, I think I would continue with the other collective agreement. I know, I appreciate, of course, that there will be a space for questions. Now, I'm off with the one that is very passionate to both myself and the chairperson seated next to me. That is the protection of the rights of the children. But, of course, balancing that with the rights of the employees, which is ensuring that there are fair processes. So the other agreement that we think is also important for this sector, that is education, is in terms of the appointment of temporary educators. You'd recall during the years of us reporting to Parliament, we used to talk about the absence of a national collective agreement to appoint temporary educators, which meant that province from province would decide how they appoint them, be it after 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, or not even have anything to convert the temporary appointment to permanent appointment. Now, this is one agreement that has been signed. This agreement, it's giving effect to the amendments of the LRA again, where now the requirement is that after 3 months, employees that are appointed temporarily so should be considered for permanent appointment. But with education, in appreciating the fact that the EA provides for the conversion of terms to permanency, we have had to infuse the requirements in terms of the LRA together with the EA sections or provisions. Of course, not losing sight of the fact that the SGPs are also playing an important role. So this agreement, in essence, if I can summarize it, it provides for the appointment of temporary educators permanently so after a period of 3 months, which is 90 days in the system. I think it's going to ensure that the stability in the system, which should be welcomed, because in some provinces they'll be terminated in December, and it's going to take 2 to 3 months again for them to get the new contracts, and the learners would be without teachers during the period to allow the administrative processes. Chair, moving to the next agreement, which is the collective agreement on picketing rules. You would know that from time to time you would see on TV that a union or organized labor in a province, they've decided to down tools, they are not at work. Now, we saw it fit that again in giving effect to our mandate to ensure that there is labor peace and we allow parties to exercise their rights, but within the provisions of the law. This agreement was concluded. It is just to ensure that there is minimum disruption of teaching and learning should the organized workers decide to picket. It also ensures that learners are protected because it sets out parameters in terms of that picketing. How far should it be from the school premise itself so that learners can safely go in and out and teachers who are not part of the picketing are not disrupted, because sometimes the picketing can be noisy and that. So that is the purpose of this agreement. I've covered that. Then, Chair, I'm going to the second part of the presentation where we are appraising the committee of the other work that we have done. Through the good and the cordial relations that we enjoy with the leadership of the current Director General and the senior management of the department, which has now translated into the same relations being enjoyed in all provinces, we have been convening the education in Indaba to focus purely on the policies that are linked to the work of the LRC. In the main, we have been looking at the issues around the post-provisioning norms, because that is one aspect that continues to be a cause for concern for the unions and the department as well, because the concern has always been that the current model does not respond to the material conditions on the ground. It is more like a one-size-fits-all. Then the brief was establish a working stream committee to look on how best can the model be revised such that it responds to what the material conditions are on the ground. The importance of the universalization of Grade R was also one of the things that we're working on, specifically with the focus on how do you reskill the workforce that you already have, because we know that Grade R was not always part of the main schooling system. Now you would have people who are currently working there who are not necessarily professionally qualified educators, but because they are in the system, you can't discard them now that Grade R is to be officially part of the mainstream. So we were looking in terms of the conditions of service for that sector. And then this year, because we started the Indaba last year, but this year when we went back to give the report on the work that had been done, we were then advised by the DG that we need to expand the brief specifically of Grade R, because now the department has been given a mandate to also put systems in place to accommodate birth to four, which is pre-formal schooling in the form of Grade R. So that is the brief that was given in the 2018 Indaba, and we are working on going back to the Indaba, which is constituted by the teacher unions as well as the heads of education with the DG and his team from National, wherein we will be putting forward proposals to say to the department, these are the policy condition, proposals for you to consider as and when you are working towards the realization of this objective. The same as the PPN, the DG advised that from the preliminary report that was tabled from the work of the work streams, we were too cautious not to upset the system. In other words, we looked at what is currently there and we tried to panel build it to respond to what the concerns were. But then the mandate that we were given by the DG and the heads of education was to say, go back, do not worry about the current policy, but come up with a policy that's going to be radical and be responding to what the country is grappling with in terms of the provisioning of educators to the school. So that is what the ELRC is working on currently, and hopefully we will be taking the recommendations to the Indaba. I'm just reflecting there on the areas that specifically are to be attended to when we put together this new proposal for the new PPN. It's listed there, Chair. I don't intend to read for the committee. Again, in terms of the ECT, I've made mention now of the revised mandate to consider 0 to 4, the way, as well as providing support to the provincial departments, the issue around qualifications. The infrastructure issues are bigger than the ELRC, but we have been allowed to make contributions to say this is something that must be considered now that the demand has increased. The facilitation is also part of our mandate. We continue providing such. I want to believe that the committee has noticed the stabilization of education in the Eastern Cape particular, because Eastern Cape is one of the provinces that was always confronted with either threats to strike or disruption of learning at the beginning of each year. And we have now managed, with the appointment of the new, who's no longer new, the HOD, we've managed to build the relations, and we have done an unprecedented thing there, because we have decided to include the school governing bodies in the discussions that are facilitated by the ELRC, because we realized that they have an interest on the discussions around that which was always the source of the dispute, which is again the PPN for the province. So we've been inviting them to be part of our discussions and solution finding processes, which has proved to be bearing very positive results. Even in other provinces, we have been providing facilitation where there is a potential for labor, for a threat to labor peace. I've cited the provinces where we had done that. Chair, I've spoken a lot without pausing. We again want to wish the Portfolio Committee for having afforded us an opportunity to come and report on the little that the ELRC is doing to contribute towards the betterment of the children of the country. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair, and for even thanking us to afford you the opportunity. I want to believe that it is your committee. You will always be welcome to work with us. And thank you very much for that presentation. Before I allow honourable members to engage with the presentation, I'll want to welcome the chairperson. You are very welcome, and to ensure the chairperson that when I finish with dealing, allowing members to raise questions. I'll request the chairperson to take a position so that this will allow me, because my other committee starts at 11 o'clock. So I'll request to leave that after you have raised the questions, then while they are responding, then you will allow me an opportunity to go to my other committee. I think I do hear you, chairperson, but we are doing the same in the other committee. Thank you very much. Can I allow honourable members to engage with the report? Thank you very much. Honourable Machesi, followed by the honourable member that I've just forgotten the name. I'm sorry. Next to Honourable Boshoff, King, yes, and followed by Honourable Bassoni. It might have. Thank you very much. After Honourable Bassoni, Honourable Boshoff. Honourable Boaters, and I think the Honourable Chairperson, and I think this would be, let us, can I maybe request members? I know, Honourable Machesi, but even, let me say this, I know. Let us prioritize questions, because you know, as the first person, you will be asking questions while, you know, you don't know as to whether the other members will research. But prioritize your questions, but if really they are serious and not raised, we will allow that opportunity too. We will allow, no, it will depend on our time. Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you very much, Honourable Machesi, and in that order, can I request the chairperson to come this side, please?
Okay, should I say thank you to the empty chair, or should I say
I'm still in the room.
The chair, okay.
I'm still an elephant.
Okay, thank you, chairperson. And also thank you to the ELRC for the presentation. I just want to find out, you know, we have, once we had that there were amendments. 1 minute, please. Protected, Honourable Machesi. Bason, I know Honourable Boshoff has commented on your change of your surname, so don't be excited on Bassoni today. You are still Basson and behave. Thank you. Honourable
Okay. As soon as there was, talks of amendments within the agreement, there's a lot of concern, specifically from the unions, with the fact that, you know, you have, there's a possibility that if you have a new teacher that is coming in that has been in the position for 3 months, that teacher can actually be automatically permanent. I know that, like, you know, I read the contract yesterday, but I just want you to just reassure us in terms of, do they become permanently, or what really happens, like, because that's, I think that was the biggest issue with the unions. And also, you know, I don't understand, well, when you spoke about the unions, to say, you know, they're kind of reluctant to say if a teacher has been on, has resigned and then comes back after 2 years, that you are now saying that they have to start from a lower level. as compared to the level that they were at when they resigned. So I just want to find out what is their what is their argument? Why is it that they are basically, you know, going against that? And then also I want to find out if a principal goes or whatever teacher goes on a sabbatical then, and say, okay, I'm going on a sabbatical for a year. But automatically that teacher, when they come back, they can actually be able to go back to the same level. So it depends also how long is the sabbatical that is allowed by the department. So maybe if you can just maybe clarify with the sabbatical issue. The other one is, you know, it's quite strange that the SAIS, you're saying that SAIS, they don't register SGB members. You know, if SGB decides to employ a teacher, that they're not automatically registered with SAIS, or did I maybe misunderstand? Okay, fine. Okay, if I misunderstood. The other thing what I don't understand is that if there is a case, can there be some kind of synergy between yourself and SAIS and the school in terms of, like, once you have a case, that when there's a hearing, that both of the bodies can be represented within that hearing, so that the decision will be a collective decision. And then if you decide to strike the teacher from the role, that it has to be something that it is decided within that room by a collective, instead of you working in silos. And also, you know, whatever decision that you effect, it doesn't become automatic throughout. It does not, it's not taken by both bodies, because now you have to have one sitting again and another one to prove that, you know, whatever that was decided there. And also, you know, the case, and the cases that have to go to the MEC, that he has to approve, that it takes about 3 years. Can't we put a timeline on that? Can't we say, okay, you know, this case must be heard in 6 months, because then you know what's going to happen. The witnesses are going to disappear from the system. So if you allow it for 3 years and we don't have timelines, I mean, who are we supposed to hold accountable if we never really put timelines? That's all from me. Thank you very much, Jim.
I may not follow as the former, the previous chairperson. Maybe I did not write as pay, but I know, oh, Mr. Brown would assist me. It's Honorable King. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. When you talked about Section 54 and people are allowed to go to SEPs to say that they have knowledge of somebody, an educator, that committed sexual offences. When you look at the principle of fairness, because that is what you're mostly based on, this can then revert back to say that you have to have some proof that the person actually did that. Is that worked into Section 54? Because I can see that this will then be challenged in court, because you will be placing an educator on a pending register, and you can then be subjected to say that I was untreated fairly before I even applied for a post, but my case was not heard already in arbitration in the court. I'm just looking at that challenge. And then my last question on the arbitration decisions. I know it's legally binding and the decision taken by an arbitrator is final, but at the CCMA over the current years we've seen most of arbitratory cases being taken for review and for appeals. Have we looked at that challenge? Because at the end of the day, an educator can then technically tell you, yes, arbitration took the decision, but in a court of law is what is actually binding to struck them off the role. And I think that's a challenge that SAIS is facing, because you can't struck them off the role unless a court of law actually challenged that decision. Thank you.
Honorable Basson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, ma'am, for your interesting presentation to us. Good. I am covered by the former speakers in some cases. I have an interest on these teachers that leave the system and come back. even those that migrate to greener pastures overseas and come back. You see, when coming back, if more than 6 years, they will be appointed 6 notches up. That means we will be again rewarding them, as you are trying to avoid this reward. Why are they not, even if you have 20 years, 30 years experience, if you leave the system, you start afresh as a new person? Because you took all, you took all, you must start afresh as the others. What is the, and...
like you will do, Honorable Son, when you go back to be a teacher next year.
Even if I'm at P1, at least. And the chairperson really is a, because it is even said, you know, these people, I have these cases, I witness them. Person taking all, coming back and become a principal of a school, or is appointed in the district. It seems as if you want to be recognized, you must leave the system and come back, then you will be promoted. As you said here, you will consider their applications for promotional purposes. But is it not unfair for the loyal disciples that were there all along to now become and be headed by somebody who went out and come back? And sometimes I notice, is it in this program, LSC, that it does not meet its target? Okay, let me say, on picketing, you just touched picketing, but not in depth. I want to know, what is your role, or how can you help the districts or the provinces in preventing the potential strikes in critical times such as exams, because the teachers like to do these things during exams, knowing that they will have an impact. And on Children's Aid, is LRC in position to give us the stats on cases that are in hand and still unresolved, and how long are they in the process? And those who are resolved, as ELRC, do you have statistics of those teachers that are found guilty and are dismissed or are out of the system, are supposed to be out of the system, as according to the final verdict of their cases? On that, I saw somewhere you mentioned the SAPS. What is your relationship in doing these other requirements of appointment, of which I think is things like vetting and screening? What is your relationship in working with them? How long should the teacher be temporary in order to be recognized and qualified to be permanent? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Two questions. The other day we had a presentation by Facebook. Before I start, this was one of the best presentations I've had in a very long time. Well done. They said to us that all SGB positions are treated the same way as people with personal numbers. So I can't quite understand that we now have to have a protocol agreement. I would like to see the SGB appointees being treated in the same fashion as personal number appointees. But somewhere there's a gap. SAFE says this and you say that. So if we can just get a little bit of feedback on that. And then if you go to your training for intermediaries on the child witness, 1.2.1, 28.3. In this section, child means a person under the age of 18. What do we do with children that are older than 18 and are still in the schooling system? Thank you very much, Chair.
Yes, no, thank you very much, Chairperson. And let me also welcome the overall report, in particular good corporate governance that the report actually display, and you know the financial component of any entity gives us a fair indication about the ethical leadership of that institution. And so I think a job well done, and we hope that the council will actually keep the books clean. Chair, the I think I must also welcome the particular focus. It's a very peculiar focus that the council actually have taken, in particular as it relates to how they have assumed the role of being the guardians of our children, in particular at schools. I'm raising it, Chair, that you know, there was one study entitled the Optimus Study by UCT that was conducted, and it says that we have in South Africa roughly 35.4% of young children that have experienced abuse at some point of their early youthful life. And further studies, Honorable Chairperson conducted, indicated actually most of the abuse takes place at home or in a environment of affinity. So what we need to do as a portfolio committee of parliament is to stop the rot of sexual predators at our schools. We just can't, we must have zero tolerance to these sexual predators. Now, the document on page 20 indicates there must be alignment of the council processes with that of SAFE to give effect to Section 120 of the Children's Act. And I think in particular, we speak about Act 38 of 2005. I think that is what we speak about. And actually, it's an amendment. And why the Act has been amended, Chairperson, because before that, it was salient on what constitutes misconduct, sexual misconduct. And the Act then defined it about pornographic material, the actual intention of rape and the actual rape, etc. Now, what concerns me here is that the realignment of the council and says it's one component of it. But we know for a fact, and we have discussed it in the portfolio committee under your leadership, Chair, that the inactive nature of the sexual offences register in South Africa, the one that are supposed to be ordained by the Department of Justice, it has been a problem, and it's a consistent problem. Now, I think it's important that if we want to be regarded as serious stewards of the South African people, that probably we need a special session with the council, would say, with Department of Social Development, with the Department of Justice, and the South African Police Services, because, you know, Madam Chair. One child to be violated sexually at school, it actually incriminates all of us. You know, I just fear for a situation one day that I must be a pain to send any one of my three girl children to school because of a sexual predator that is on the loose there. Now, I agree there is this unfortunate cases where people get wrongly accused. But whatever we must do and say as the portfolio committee, if anyone just gets accused, Honorable Chairperson, that person must be off the school terrain. That person should not be allowed to actually continue with the educative role, even if they are actually proven ultimately to be innocent. Because, in fact, wrong accusations, it's a minute minority. The fact of the matter is the majority of people that get accused for sexual misconduct has actually perpetrated that date against our children. So I think we probably need to have a very specific session with all the role players where we speak about not school violence. I know there's a big debate today about the safety and security of educators, vice versa, violence directed by the learners against them. But I think what we must do, Honorable Chairperson, is to have a specific section on sexual violations of our learners by educators, so that we can actually have the necessary ministerial leadership of all sector departments present, so that we start to make our work more relevant as a portfolio committee. And I think that is my plea, but I am fairly impressed that I think there's a leadership here, and I want to say we must abuse that leadership in the interest of our children, Honorable Chairperson Diabule.
The relationship between them and the and state regarding the issue wherein they said to overrule two bodies on a decision regarding rape. It goes to me, I wanted to check what really is state's responsibility in that regard if they are to overrule two bodies being allocated.
Thank you very much. I think leadership of ELRC, basically, we're all excited about this presentation. Really, it touches so many areas where, as a committee, we always discuss and not having answers. Now, if there is this breakthrough, it's something that is very much commendable. But for me, again, I want us to be realistic. When it comes to false accusations, most of the time those cases can be taken as false, whereas we know very well it's not. Like in our communities, basically rural communities, the issue of bribes is very rife. Or Mr. Bodes will rape Umdwanaga ka Mrs. Person. Mrs. Person, the socioeconomic status is very bad. Then Mr. Bodes at night will come and okay, no, I fell in with okay, Mr. Smia will come at night and pay. It's cultural in our communities. Mrs. Person is in need of this 10,000 that is said. Otherwise, there is all the evidence that this has been done. It's worse sometimes even Mrs. Person's child is pregnant. You know, those are the things where we say, I don't know why or how are we dealing with such, but that learner will not come forward to testify, and it's the case that is just killed. Mr. Bot or Mr. Smear is free of charge. And we are expecting this man to continue, you know. Same thing, of late we know that even us females now, we are. I hope you can even talk to us about the cases where it's us who are abusing the young men, the boys.
And the girls.
And the girls too. It's worse because we even, you know, I mean to say, really, those cases, what is it that you do? It's painful, but we must accept those are the things that are happening, and how do we tackle such things coming from those cases? But I'm very excited on that one of not exposing our learners for secondary trauma. I think you have done it very well when it comes to that. Our children have been, you find that most of the cases will be dropped because you can't expect this 10-year-old, you know, to keep on testifying and going through the same experience now and again. I think really we must commend you on that one. But this synergy between you and SAFE, everyone has talked about, maybe one day we need to have a discussion like this where two of you are here so that we can understand where your relationship when it comes to the issue of cases. Like, I just thought of the synergy when it comes to your conversion, where you convert to permanency after 3 months, whereas SAFE is saying after a year, that is the probation period, you know? How do we marry the two? What is it that we do? So that we see that synergy, we don't have one doing another thing and you do another thing. And tell us, what time frame are you looking at responding to this issue of PPPN that needs to respond to the material conditions? Because it's one thorny issue that you have in the system. We know the province, you know the situation, what is happening. It's one thing that we can be happy to see it being finalized. Let me stop there. That's the disadvantage of coming late to the meeting. Honourable Matches wanted to add something on her questions.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to find out, in terms, you mentioned the qualification of ECD practitioners, okay? Because, you know, we don't know now that they're going to be formalized, if you can maybe just give us an idea what are the qualifications supposed to be. And also, we had a Jobs for Cash report that came out with a lot of cases. Would you know how far are we with those cases? And also, you know, when we looked at SAFE as well, they have a lot of cases, backlog of many cases. Is there that, maybe it goes back to the synergy thing, like, you know, what happens, like, they have a backlog, do you have a backlog, and, you know, what are you doing about that, and, you know, like, if you can just maybe also specifically on the Jobs for Cash report.
May I hand over to you?
Thank you, Chair. I'll respond, and then my chairperson will add on what I would have omitted. Chair, in terms of the, I'm not necessarily going to link the questions to the honourable members. I'll just talk to the questions themselves. In terms of the issue around the conversion of temporal educators, what happened, or the concerns by teacher unions about the new appointments, the agreement itself, maybe we made an omission of not sharing copies of the agreement. The agreement is very explicit on the process that is to be undertaken to determine the suitability of an educator that must be converted to permanence. In other words, it's not automatic that because you are a temp, you are in the system, after 3 months, then you are appointed permanently. So there are a range of other considerations. Number one, there must be a vacant substantive post that you are appointed against. If not, then there must be a need for that. If not, because in the system you'd have different types of temporal educators. There are those who are there to substitute educators who are off sick. So it doesn't mean that because you are a temporal educator, you have been there for 3 months, automatically you'll be converted. So there are those considerations, but the agreement itself, as I'm saying, the process is explained there, the categories, even in terms of who is eligible and what are the considerations. for you to even start the process of doing such. And you being converted, perhaps we are using these terms interchangeable, not necessarily within the context of the law itself. That permanent conversion does not necessarily mean permanent. You are appointed indefinitely, subject to the contract being terminated by either of the parties. The probation requirement is still there. You're still required to serve the probation. But I'm saying for the context of the presentation, we're talking about the conversion to permanence. That is just a term that is used loosely so. But it simply means that you are appointed indefinitely subject to the termination of the contract. But any other obligation that you need to satisfy, specifically around the requirement of serving probation, is still there. It doesn't fall away. So I've tried to group two questions there. The issues, Chairperson, around the SAIS and SGPs, no, maybe we did not say it such that it is clear. What we were saying is the ELRC only has jurisdiction to deal with the cases of employees that are employed by the state. The ELRC and SAIS, when it comes to how they treat educators, differs vastly so. SAIS oversees all educators, regardless of who the employing party is. It can be the private school or the SGP. The issue that we were raising is, because our jurisdiction is limited to those that are employed by the state, we are concerned about the educators who would have committed the same type of offenses, who are working in the same public schools. But because the law is such that the ELRC's jurisdiction is confined to those that are employed by the state. Now, what we are bringing up for discussion is to say, let us do something about those ones that are out there as well. But currently, there is no provision for us to entertain such, because such cases are dealt with by the CCMA. So that's what we were trying to bring forward. But it doesn't temper at all with what says is responsibility insofar as all the teachers that work within the country are concerned. So that is still there. The issues around the synergy between SAIS and the ELRC, Chair, I did make mention that we have made the similar presentation to the Ethics Committee, which has welcomed positively the proposal that we have put forward to say indeed it's high time that we draw a synergy between their processes and our processes such that we protect the profession at large whilst we are protecting the children of the country. So it is something that we are working on, and I also made mention of the proposed protocol. I think that was one of the questions to say, you're talking about SAIS and ELRC, what about Department of Social Development? What about the SAPS? What about the Department of Justice and so forth? There's a draft protocol, just that the DG has left, but there's a draft protocol which is subjected to their own internal processes, which will be finalized, which will then entail collaboration and working together of all these different institutions and so forth, the role players in the system, to ensure that we attend to the same. The issue around the MEC's response to the appeal process, we don't have a say in that. We can only make recommendations. But now the appeal process, insofar as the sexual offences cases, has fallen away. I think one of the members made mention of the fact that an arbitration award can only be set aside by a court of law. So now that the department will no longer be dealing with these cases, but cases will be dealt with in terms of an inquiry by the arbitrator, once an award is issued, there is no role that will be played by the MEC there, because there is no appeal. A person must take the award to the labor court to have it reviewed. And again, we need to explain some aspect of that process with due respect to the members, because their understanding might differ from one person to the other. What gets to be taken on review to be considered by the labor court is not the merits of the case, whether you have raped the child or you have sexually offended the child. What is taken to review on review is the conduct of the presiding officer. In this case, it's the conduct of the arbitrator, not the dismissal or not dismissal part of it, the conduct of the arbitrator. You'll be approaching the labor court to say, the presiding officer in this case, which is the arbitrator, has erred in not considering my evidence or in doing X, Y, Z. But it doesn't carry the same, because the MEC would have said, fine, you were dismissed, I am overturning the dismissal, you have to be reinstated. The Labour Court will never say reinstate. The Labour Court will say we are directing the appropriate forum to set the matter down to be heard before a new commissioner. So in other words, you still have an obligation to go and testify and lead your evidence that, no, I have not done what I'm accused of having done. I'm trying to explain. But the MEC would have just decided, based on whatever reasons that you have finished, whether they are upholding the dismissal sanction or they are not. So that is the difference between the two processes. The Labour Court will say we must set the matter down again so that you are afforded a fair opportunity to go and present your evidence before a new commissioner, should the court find that the arbitrator is erred in hearing your matter. But again, there are some cases that the MEC will still receive, but not specifically on sexual offences, but that will be the departmental processes. But there, that's something that we are also planning to see and engage the respective HODs, because it's proving to be a problem. Chair, in terms of the section that I've projected there on the screen, you would note the wording of that section. It's saying any person who has knowledge, it can be a neighbour. Your example is a very practical and a relevant example. Remember, there's no onus on that neighbor who's aware of what is happening in the community to investigate, no. Who is authorized by law to investigate is SAPS. So that is why the Act is written in such a way that anyone who has knowledge, a grandma, an oma in the community, should that grandma be aware that there's a certain teacher that is sexually offending a child, or not even a teacher, that person, the law obliges that you go and report, appreciating that you do not have authority to investigate, nor do you have the skill. That is why the Act is saying any person, not an institution, not anyone who has the resources and the authority to investigate. Because why do you report to SAPS? Because SAPS is the structure that has the responsibility to investigate. Hence, the report from the registrar will be saying there's a pending case. It's pending because it has to be investigated. So there's a difference also between the effect of this and the effect of your name being in the register B. Register B is very clear, you can't be employed because you are found to be unsuitable to work. So that is why even the same Act draws a distinction whose name can be added on the sexual offenders register. It is only the name of a person who is convicted. Why is there emphasis on conviction? Because the court of law, which is the appropriate structure, would have made a determination that you are guilty of that. Therefore, your name must be in that register. But this is a separate process, because here's a neighbor who has information. Give it to police, let the police do it. Deal with the situation. So that's the difference. I've covered, Chair, the issues around the review.
Do you know, Ms. Fokker? I Ms. Bridgeland. Before you continue, Honorable Boshoff wanted to inquire something on that.
Thank you very much, Chair. With regard to reporting, we know what happens to whistleblowers. What protection will be given to a gogo or a neighbor or something like that if they are aware of this case? Because we do find that our people are too afraid to come out and speak out. So what protection is there for them?
I don't necessarily want to talk for SAPS, but I want to believe, Chair, that once you have reported that matter and it's with SAPS, it is going to be the state versus the alleged perpetrator. Therefore, at no point will the name of the person who has reported surface anywhere. But it's going to be the state's case, and anywhere in any proceedings, even them investigating, they now own that report. So your name is not going to be mentioned. But again, perhaps these are some of the issues that in this protocol agreement that the DG is working on with all of us, we need to get clarity on. And I also need to hasten to mention, now that the question is being asked, part of what we are engaging says on is us putting together, even if it's a pamphlet, and we run an advocacy campaign trying to empower our communities, the parents, the learners, to say you are protected by law. If you know, go to the police station, report your name, won't be diverged, nobody's going to know. So that is the one of the initiatives that we have proposed, to say that let us work jointly, even if we work through QLTC structures. We come up with a pamphlet, we go and address these communities, we tell them that you are required by law to go and report, but nobody's going to know. But equally, caution them that there will be consequences if, because you don't like your neighbor, you go and fabricate stories. So that's the kind of advocacy and training and education and awareness that we need to put our resources together and run out there. I thought, let me link that now. Then there was a question about the concern on reappointment. Why do we reward those that have left? Chair, regrettable, that is what parties have agreed to, that you still need to recognize experience. And I think even in the public service generally, experience is recognized. But we are holding a view that this is going to act as a deterrent, the same as the agreement on the inquiry by the arbitrator for sexual offenses. Once the educators become aware that there are these initiatives that are being put in place to curb these type of practices, psychologically it's going to act as a deterrent. A person now will not just decide to resign this month and next month they want to re-enter the system. They'll think twice before they want to cash their pensions, unless, of course, they have compelling reasons. So we are relying on, I know the members are finding this funny, we are relying, Chairperson, on this advocacy campaign where we create awareness, and we would want the committee to help us in doing such as well, so that teachers are sensitized that there are these processes that are put in place, and then this thing acts more as a deterrent. Then in terms of the picketing, what it becomes our role insofar as preventing such, Chair, I did make mention of the fact that whenever we are alerted that there's a potential for labor unrest, we jump in, we don't ask for invitation, we approach the relevant parties and we tell them that let's sit around the table and try to prevent this. But unfortunately, as I said earlier on, in some instances you only learn about the incident on TV. So what we are saying is that anyone who is even intending of organizing a picketing, they must know that it's regulated. You have to serve the employer a notice and all that. So while they are serving a notice, if there's a need for us to jump in, we'll jump in and try. But we continuously work in terms of our mandate to prevent these type of occurrences from happening. But we're saying in instances where we are unable to, let at least be regulated so that you don't have a chaotic situation on your hands. In terms of the unresolved and the resolved cases, Chair, we did not come with such information prepared, but we can make it available through your secretary. And I also need to explain something here. We are saying previously these cases were presided over by the departmentally appointed officers. So we don't have statistics there. We only have statistics of the cases that have been referred to us by the individuals who are claiming unfair dismissal. But I'm sure the respective provincial departments would know. But I also need to mention that the implementation of the agreement will only start on the date when the agreement was signed. So any other pending case that was already part head or the department had started the processes, they're going to have to finalize those cases. We can't take them over, because the agreement can't be implemented retrospectively. It's only going to be implemented from the date that is signed. So, and the requirement is that let the department conduct the investigation. Once they are done with the investigation, they refer the matter to us in the appropriate forms. Then we start the process from that end. But the cases that were already there, the department still has full control of it. But again, if there's a protocol agreement, they obviously would take into consideration now these requirements in terms of declaring or finding these teachers unsuitable to work with the learners. The issue around what is our relationship with SAPS, Chair, I did make mention that these are the initiatives that we have put in place. We have established conducts, and again, this is linked to their participation in the finalization of that protocol agreement that's going to regulate how we all work together. So that is the issue that we're reporting. The SGB appointees, I think I've responded to that. Then the definition of a child as contained in the training manual for the intermediaries. Chair, that definition is in terms of the criminal law. Once a person is older than 18, that person is considered to be an adult in terms of the laws of the country. So their processes obviously will be dealt like any other ordinary case where an adult has come forward to lodge a complaint about being sexually harassed. But the definition as contained in the manual is informed by the criminal law. And in terms of the case itself, it will still be heard. But once a person is 18 years, that person will be afforded a choice whether they want to testify through a third person or they are comfortable testifying directly. But we will still hear the case. We won't say, no, your case doesn't belong here. For as long as they are still within the school, that case, and if the matter is referred to us, we will deal with it in that way. Then I think the special session, we have noted the comments from the Honourable Member about the need for a special session, and I also believe that at that time, hopefully we would have the signed off protocol agreement, which we would come and be talking to it, because the purpose of the special session would be to bring all the role players together to explain what are they doing. Then the concern that was, or the question that was asked specifically on what is the responsibility of SAIS, what powers does SAIS have to overturn a finding by two processes, that is the internal disciplinary process and the ELRC. I did make mention, Chair, that this is as a result of not having witnesses. SAIS's requirement is that if they conduct the investigation, they schedule the matter for the purposes of determining whether this person has done what is alleged to have been done. They also require witnesses. That is why we are saying that it is a problem right now, because those witnesses must be in the internal process, must be at the ELRC. Now, if the matter is referred to SAIS and there are no witnesses at SAIS, regrettable, despite the ELRC having issued an award to say the person is guilty, SAIS has no choice but to say we don't have evidence. So we are not reporting it as a way of finding anything wrong with what SAIS is doing, but we are highlighting the limitation that they have as a result of the Act, which requires that they follow their own specific process for them to make a determination whether the person should be struck off the roll or not. I think, Chair, I did link your comment about what is transpiring or happening in the communities, and also the synergy with SAIS. I think I've tried to explain it. The issue around the conversion, 3 months versus 1 year probation, I have also covered with your guidance, Chair. I will request that my chairperson add if I've omitted anything.
Chair, you can add, but I was worried, chairperson. OGS has talked a lot without you even offering a bottle of water.
That was fine. Thanks, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I'm going to be very, very brief. I think that the General Secretary has covered most of the issues. I thought we'd cautiously stay away from people leaving the department to cash their pensions, but she touched on it. Unfortunately, it at some point it became a very serious thing. We have a plethora of cases. One educator that left today and tomorrow was brought back, literally. There is no gap in between. But in the process of coming back, the following day was busy processing, you know, the pension. And so the agreement seeks to deal with all these unfortunate situations. I just want to deal with the second collective agreement by prefacing an arbitration that I personally did. And I hope that the honorable members would be able to relate. In Northwest in 2013, I did an arbitration of an educator who had been found guilty and dismissed by the department for raping a child, a learner. The matter was postponed on two occasions because the learner was not there. On the third occasion, I took it upon myself to phone the grandmother that stays with the learner, because I wanted to plead with her to allow the child to come. And she said to me on the phone, "My child," and that's how she addressed me. She said, "My child, this child has been called to two or three previous hearings. The department and the appeal says, and on all three occasions she comes back traumatized. She doesn't sleep for at least 2 days. No state employee comes to help me to take her to the clinic, to get medication, and for her to cope with what she has gone through." And this is very serious. And she said to me, "I am not allowing her to come to your arbitration," and that's it. You know, we can resolve to subpoenas, which are legal instruments. But what's a subpoena to a lady who stays in the rural area? It means nothing. She says she's not coming. And unfortunately, you know, we had to then end up with a settlement agreement where this educator was going to be moved to another school, because there was no evidence. So the only evidence that I had in front of me was the one presented by his attorney, and the department could not rebut it. You know, and that's the difficulty that we have. But I also want to mention, which I'm sure you would find interesting. Last night as I was going through my preparation for this meeting, I bumped on an article by Jessica Shelver in 2016. And the article is entitled Western Cape Education on Strengthening Vetting Systems for Staff Appointments, and she specifically deals with the scourge of sexual harassment and sexual misconduct in the school. And to tie in with Honorable Member Boshoff's issue on the vetting that happens, you will see that what is quite apparent from her article is that the Western Cape has decided on its own just to employ other measures, which are not necessarily in terms of the EA or any other legislation, but clearly they're saying this is a problem, we must do something about it. You know, even if you're employed by the SGB, we will still have to vet you, you know, because, and she makes the point that the General Secretary was making, that the certificate it says really says you are professionally, you know, qualified. It says nothing beyond that point. And she makes another interesting point. She says half the time people are saying my application is still pending, and the schools will still, the SGBs will still employ you, because they are saying we are not going to be frustrated by that process. They'll employ you without the SAY certificate, you know, which leaves a huge door open for these pedophiles to sit in our schools. And I thought it speaks volumes. And we are addressing a great number of these issues that Jessica raises in this article. Cindy has covered the issue of permanence and probation. The fact that you're converted and you're made permanent, it does not escape you from your probation. You know, that issue still stands, as well as the relationship with faith has been covered. The issue on sabbatical, and this is the mistake that people make, and I've explained this thing. If you want to take sabbatical, let's start with sabbatical is not provided for in terms of the EEA. What I explained to the unions when we met with them was that there's, in law, you can still take unpaid leave. So you can't say I am unable to leave the system and come back and not be penalized, because the problem is when you resign and want to come back. So I'm saying the parties at the ELRC want to protect the abuse that is happening. But for those people who've got honest reasons, I want to go, you know, my husband has been moved to another country. He's on a mission for 2 years, and I want to go and be there, or I want to have a child, and I want to extend my maternity. The basic conditions of employment still provide for those reasons. So you are able to utilize that and not exit the system. The challenge is with people who exit the system for purposes of cashing the pension and other wrong reasons, and, you know, and coming back. So those issues could easily be dealt with. I need to say this, and I'm not sure, maybe my general secretary would not be happy with this. Part of the abuse that we have, and what this Section 188, capital letter A, collective agreement addresses, is that the departments take too long to make these appeals. You ask the question, why can't they be done within 6 months? We'll have to amend the EEA. The EEA does not provide a timeline. We have had cases where the appeal is pending for 10 years. That person has been found guilty of serious misconduct, has appealed, is sitting in the system earning a salary. Now, 10 years later, you want to conclude that appeal, you can't argue that the employment relationship is irretrievably broken down. How do you argue that when you've kept the person, a child molester, for 10 years? And these are the problems that we have. And you know, to just try and find nice language to use it, we're also assisting in closing these gaps. So at least for the sexually related misconduct, we have one hearing. We're addressing everything that would have been done. Do it once, as you said, Honorable Chair. Can't keep the child coming back to testify. It's horrific to go and testify on a number, 3 or 4 occasions about something that happened to you, bad, how your privacy was invaded. I don't think any, even adults would find it easy to do, you know, and this is a child. So we're condensing these to make sure that it happens once, it happens before a qualified and seasoned arbitrator, the evidence is tested, there's an outcome, boom. You know, talk about expeditious dispute resolution. Thank you, Chair.
You say, I wonder, you know, you deal with these cases, you see these children now and again, as to say, where do you vent out? It's so, you know, with us, just to have this session with you, you can imagine how these things have got an impact on your life also. It's quite difficult. Honorable Boshoff.
Thank you, Chair. There's one question that I also forgot to ask. In terms of you know, the strike action that you're talking about, the distances between the school, and I've never seen any clear guideline, but maybe you can just, maybe I've just missed that, like what should be the distance between the school and the picketers. And also, Chair, the other one is just an issue that I want to bring to the committee to say, you know, just listening to what you just said about the Western Cape. The Western Cape does not only have a private vetting company. They also have a call center that deals directly with learners or even teachers that can call should there be any abuse at school, any kind of abuse that the learners are experiencing in school, even the teachers themselves. They can anonymously, you know, make a phone call whereby they have access to a social worker, a psychiatrist, a psychologist, police, you know, directly. They can actually do that. So, you know, I'm just wondering what is our position as a committee, because I think, you know, if we see, you know, a province or, you know, a district performing well in certain issues, that, you know, can we take the liberty to sort of, like, you know, prompt them, because this is a province that is doing it with the same similar budget that they extended to all other provinces, but within the budget they are finding ways to be able to tackle this kind of issues. So is there a way, like, as a committee that we can say, you know, we have done a campaign with ourselves as the cluster of basic education. But, you know, it's not echoing. It's not something that, you know, that people are hearing us saying it. But I think, you know, maybe as a committee, maybe we can look into it and say, Can we ask other provinces to do the same thing? Because we have asked to say, can all the other provinces have a call center? Can they do the vetting themselves? Like find a way within the budget to do that? I mean, these are good things that we can, that can be implemented in other provinces. But do we have the powers or even to advise to say, you know, if they can do that? So I'm just asking.
Thank you, Chesh. My colleagues touched on what I wanted to say as well. But with regard to these cases that you're referring to, is there any way that you could point us to a case number so that we can do a bit of studying on these cases to see where the fallouts are in case we are contacted with something to that effect? And then secondly, you speak of a child that after three sessions they just don't want to go. How do we go about with our learners with disabilities? Because we do have learners with severe intellectual disabilities. How do we nurture them in a case of a rape incident? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Maybe before I even give to ARC, I think what Honourable Matthews is raising is exactly what is our role as a committee, is to say, having learned the good practices from various provinces, because you'll find that Province A has got its act. That is why there are instances where we even call them under one roof, where they can, and I believe they even have their platforms, you know, where they share these good practices. It's one of the good practices where we have the provinces, but bearing in mind that we cannot say as a committee, we recommend you do these provinces. It's their concurrent functions and what we must understand that section of the Constitution. But in almost everything, that is our role as the portfolio committee, where when we have learned good practices, even over our oversights, when we share with them, those are the things that we can be sharing with other provinces, as to say there is a good practice that is happening in a certain province. What if you do this? Because, yeah, to respond just to state, there is nothing that we can say, Province A, do this, but we can always share and recommend that these are good practices that that one province can do, learning from each other. And I believe the community will continue to do as such. Chairperson, can I hand over to you? I see your mic is still on, so I thought...
Oh, no, my apologies. It was not my intention to answer, but I'll answer. I thought the GS would take them. In terms of the distance regarding picketing, that's 5 meters. That agreement is also based on the guidelines that are published by the Department of Labor on picketing. Insofar as the cases, I suppose it would be a bit difficult. There are the ones that we do as arbitrators, so you'll find the reports and you'll find the awards from the ELRC, but the ones that don't end up with us are the difficult ones, which we assume, you know, they will be found in the provinces. But insofar as child with disabilities, the intermediaries are there, you know, to assist. And that's why we think that... My apologies, that's Siri, and I didn't ask anything. I was saying the intermediaries would obviously assist with that, and that's why we think that it's a plus to have this one hearing, because you have it where the child, with or without disability, is then protected, and with somebody who knows how to deal with, you know, with the child, whereas you would then have it differently in the different provinces when it's done by the different departments of education. Cheers.
You know, your presentation was encouraging us to engage with you more and more. I think I need to agree with those who said there is leadership in ELRC, and wishing you that you continue to do this. Really, you give us hope, as to say, when it comes to all these cases that you are dealing with, and also the labor council's issues that always arise, you are there to give that fresh breath to the department. May you continue to do so, knowing very well that you no more report to us as we used to do, but you are one entity that now and again we need to call you so that we get a progress report and the update on what is it that you have agreed upon on the council that you are working with. Thank you very much, leadership of LRC. Always confirming that we'll always become, we'll be always remain the members of the family of basic education, no matter what. You don't report to us, but you are dealing with our issues now and again. So now and again, we'll touch base so that we'll see the progress, what is happening. Thank you ever so much.
Honourable Chair, thank you from the ELRC, and thank you to all the members of the portfolio committee. It's always an honour for us to come and just explain where we are and the efforts that we are making as the ELRC, as the parties within the ELRC, the Department of Basic Education, start to end the ATU to improve the quality of learning and teaching, and most importantly, to ensure that we comply with Section 28 of the Constitution, and that's ensuring that the rights of the learners are of paramount importance. Thank you.
Very much. We will allow you to move out whilst we are continuing with our business as the portfolio committee.
Thank you.
Honourable members, I think we can start now with engaging, looking at the draft report that is in front of us today. Can we do as we always do, just to take it all at the same time, where we go page by page, we look at the corrections, things that we want to correct, in whatever way it can be, spelling, whatever errors, or the content in which we believe what we said, the paragraphs or that sentence does not catch the essence of that. So as we move page by page, let us correct. But we always encourage us to say it's worse when it's towards the end, where we look at our recommendations. That is where we need to be very specific and be sure as to say that is the recommendation that we agreed upon as the portfolio committee. Can we then start the process, honourable members? Page 1. Yeah, I know at the beginning there is not that much because it's just the documents and where the whole issue of the report is underpinned. Let me go to page 2. Oh, yeah, man. Nami, I will make sure that I do. I will bring her one. Page 3. No, other than that, there is a small friend that I saw, who Deputy Minister of Social Development, Uzud, was having. It was a friend of this size, holding the, yeah, I think so, you've got one, okay, page 4, page 5, page 6. Seven. Eight. page 8. Page 9. We are now on page 10. Page 11. Page 12. Page 25. Page 26.
The performance indicators, it stays at the bottom, not
page 28. Page 29. Page 30. Page 14. 41. Page 46, page 47, to Parliament, because the department submits to Parliament, table everything to Parliament then. Yeah. That is page 52. Page 53. Yeah, you know what, I was looking at, but I think we are well covered, because I think, honourable members, when it comes to the issue of recommendations, it's where we must be heard. The issue of AIs, I hope with that recommendation is strong enough that we must be heard, that when it comes to the issues of infrastructure, the implementing IAs, I'm sorry, IAs, yeah, it does capture that it's one area where, what it says, it's number, it's page 53, it's page 53, bullet number, where is it? It's 1, 2, 3, 4 from the bottom on page 53. It says put more effective or stringent penalties against implementing agents who perform poorly in relation to the ACD program. Yeah, I wanted it, but I think it does capture the essence. And also the other one, I see them all. The other one, honourable members, is this one on conditional grants. I can't see it. You know, I've been reading it on the computer now here. Where is the one? Where is the one on the conditional grants? Because as a committee, really, we need to be heard, as to say, the utilization of the grants, when, because the grants are for those specific, you know, exactly, when comes to the issues of math and science, learners with severe international disability, we feel that as a committee, if they are not exhausted or well utilized, let us call for the department, let us be, I'm pleading, but where is that one, so that we look at it as to say, does it carry the emphasis that we wanted to carry that much on the implementing agent, on the grants. Oh, let us write it, honourable members, still on page 53, bullet number 4 from the top. It says provide the necessary support to the relevant PEDs to ensure effective and efficient utilization of conditional grants. It shows that we want to talk about, but it doesn't carry this weight as to say, let us see the department, really, that the provincial PEDs. I'm not sure, really, as I'm raising it, I don't know how can we put it so that it can be felt that, exactly.
To put more emphasis.
Yeah.
Very important.
Exactly. How do we...
I don't know how I read this as fully as on page 50, but submitted progressive report on the implementation of the supplemental standard to date within 3 of assumption.
Oh, yeah, there is something wrong there. Okay. Yeah, within 3 months of the adoption of this report, yeah, it's 3 months. Where we need progress.
3 months.
Honorable.
I'm on the grant,
yeah. There you just let us just add months there. Yeah, can we on the grant?
Something like those provinces that do not execute the grant are held to account. So they don't comply. Yeah, non-compliance will lead to, because we are struggling with our PEDs, not all of them.
Mm-hmm. Not all of them.
Yeah,
they're even to give more, you know, we need that in treasury. These are the grants that constrict their resources. So how to make sure, let us be jealous of these grants, you know, come people speak. Your language.
What we must also have is a process must be put in place to hold these PEDs to account if they do not comply to the utilization of their grants according to the EU's laws and standards.
Thank you.
Chairperson, I think you have made my task easier. I just try to capture as members put it. Regarding the recommendation on conditional grants, we could strengthen the recommendation by putting it as it is and adding to the recommendation the following words: there should be consequence management for those provinces that do not comply. And then the next part of the recommendation, a process should be put in place to ensure that the officials account.
You will polish it, but we are catching the sense of what we are saying, at least.
Thank you. That's the one on districts. It follows a similar pattern. It will read thus: strengthen district monitoring and support to schools. Again, there should be consequence management for those districts that underperform. Thank you.
Chair, on page 54, ensure that the second chance matric program is inclusive of learners with special needs. Yes, thank you, but we've been asking this for 2 years and it still hasn't been done, so we have to have a timeline that this is, that the department makes sure that these learners have the opportunity as from next year. Thank you.
Honourable members, that is the draft report then that is in front of us that we have just amended and agreed upon. Honourable Machesi.
Just something minor, Chairperson. You know, the report, when you read, like for instance, I'm just going to make an example. You've got the special needs education, you have an abbreviation for it, but then you find out in certain areas you are introducing a new word, like with abbreviation. So there's no sequencing. So, for instance, on page 53, we have special needs education, SNE, which is fine. And then we have page 53, you have education departments, provincial education departments. But all along, we've been saying PEDs, but we've never put it as in full. I think when you introduce, basically what I'm saying is like there has to be some consistency. When you introduce the word and abbreviation, we do it once, and then it, you know, we sort of have it throughout the report. Thank you.
But no, it's fine, as we are saying, if we have introduced it, because definitely when it was first introduced to us, provincial department, education department, then PEDs. So as we go along, let us stick to PEDs and whatnot. No, it's fine. It's just that my that clean up, as we say. Okay. The report is in front of us, honorable members. Is there anyone who is moving for the adoption of this report? Honorable Boshoff. Honorable Basson. Honorable Basson.
Chairperson, I move the adoption of this report with amendments thereof. Thank you
very much. Any seconder to the adoption of the report? Can you switch off your microphone. I'm not even talking.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Oh, the hard work that we have put on this, I know. For the past 2 weeks, we have been working like crazy, but thank you very much for your perseverance, the contributions. It was worth it. The meeting is adjourned. We'll meet next week.
Yeah.